On Sunday, AMC aired what critics variously called a surprising, sweet, ambiguous, or much too neat ending to the popular series Mad Men, as viewers said goodbye to one of cable's most successful shows. Baby boomers prepare to do the same for the longest-running late-night institution. Talk show host David Letterman ends his run tonight after more than three decades. In this hour of midday, we'll discuss the finales of these landmark TV franchises and invite listeners to share their favorite memories and their thoughts about the future of cable television. Also, a conversation about ethical concerns regarding television news. Baltimore Sun TV critic David Zerowick joins us for Midday on Media after the news from NPR. And welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Rodericks here for our second hour. Thanks for sticking around. Today is Wednesday. It's the third Wednesday of the month, and that means Baltimore Sun TV critic David Zerowick, my colleague from Calvert Street, joining us here in the studio for Midday on Media. David, nice to see you.
Nice to see you. I love that music. Can we have that whenever
that
I come on?
I
love that.
You know, we have been using it.
That's fantastic.
It's from a movie with John Travolta, Gene Hackman.
I love it.
Danny DeVito.
That's great.
Dennis.
I love that riff. Thank you. Between the coffee and the riff. What do I know? I'm a TV critic. What do I know of movies?
What's the movie?
I don't know.
Dennis Farina or Farini.
Yeah.
Remember, he used to be on Cop Squad.
I remember him.
TV.
Yeah.
I always liked him.
Yeah.
Yeah. John Travolta plays a guy named Chili.
Okay. Chili. I like the music. I didn't know about the movie.
What's the movie?
I don't know, but the music got me jacked
That's
up.
That's our first
I'm ready
trivia
to go.
Question. Our first trivia question of the hour today. 410-662-8780. It's not from a TV show. It's from a movie.
That's why I don't know.
You know, we used to do trivia questions here,
did,
remember?
And I never got any of them. You gave them up. They were an embarrassment.
We used all those TV themes, TV theme music from the 70s and 80s. It's like you didn't even watch TV
in the 70s and 80s. It was like it'd be the biggest show in the history of the world. MASH. No, it's Green Acres, Dave.
Listen, we got several things to talk about today. We're going to save a segment of the show to discuss ethics and TV news, all right? So that'll be a bit later on in the hour with David Zerowick here. But first, this past Sunday night was the series finale of the landmark AMC series Mad Men, and featured an ambiguous ending. Well, some critics called it a sweet ending. Some called it a surprise ending. I saw one critic called it a too neat ending, too neatly packaged ending. Anyway, we'd like to hear from our listeners today on that. If you have some reflections on the finale of Mad Men on Sunday night. And Robbie in Timonium has an answer to my trivia question, music.
I actually do know it. I actually did see that film. Yeah.
Oh, Robbie's outdoors in Timonium. Did you hear the siren going by? Robbie, what's...
Yeah.
Are you okay?
Oh, I'm good. I'm just sitting at a red light.
What's that movie, Robbie?
It was Get Shorty.
Yeah. Get Shorty.
I actually saw that. Yeah. Great. That's you made it. Thanks. I didn't remember.
Oh, wait a minute. Who's the female lead in that? I was in love with her, and now I forgot her name. Renee Russo.
You know, that kind of defines a baby boomer.
It does, doesn't
it? I used to be in love with her, Renee, and now I forgot her name for media women.
Hey, Robbie, was Robbie still on the line? Shouldn't we?
Yep, I'm right here.
Put your address. Give your address to our producer, Connor Graham. I'm going to send you some steaks, okay?
Sounds good.
Some steaks.
Thanks a lot,
man.
Murray's
steaks.
I don't know about this, Robbie. If you start getting weird offers in the mail.
It's what I love to say to people. Put your address down. I'm going to send you some steaks.
Yeah.
I'm going to send you a set of tires.
I'm not going to say what I'm thinking. I'm going to bite my tongue for once. Okay.
We're going to talk about the finale of Mad Men.
Yeah.
But first, we're going to deal with David Letterman. Tonight, after more than three decades, this is 33 years as a late-night talk show host, 6,000 broadcasts plus, David Letterman retires. Last night was his penultimate show, and he had Bill Murray as a guest, and that choice was sentimental because Bill Murray was David Letterman's first guest on Dave's first show back on Late Night in 1982 on NBC.
You were in the stripes. I missed the first part of the show, by the way. What happened? Is it going well? I know this is the first show, and I think this guy needs a little support. Dave Letterman. All right, okay, good. All right, okay.
Where were we?
You were going to ask me about the last time I was on your show.
Oh, yeah. Well, this may not be of any interest to anybody, and it's barely interesting to me, but let me...
they're pumped up out there. Right?
What are you playing with there?
It's just lint. It's just lint from inside my pocket. Here, I got more.
Now, this is interesting. You were in a movie last year that was number 5 in the box office tabulations.
No, it was number 3.
Number 3. You're a major star, and yet here you are playing with lint balls.
1982 with Bill Murray. Bob Dylan was a musical guest. Tonight we don't know exactly what's going to happen.
Foo Fighters is going to be the
So you do know?
Yes, the last musical guest is going to be Foo Fighters tonight.
Wow, okay.
Foo Fighters.
Do you know, have
his
any
favorite
other...
band.
Is that right?
And and his favorite song. They announced it a couple hours ago or confirmed it couple hours ago. Yeah.
Okay. David Letterman, I was a huge fan of this show for the longest time from NBC. And then when he switched to CBS, when I could stay up, could stay awake and watch it, I loved
it. When you could still remember the names of women you were in love with in films.
Yeah, back then, back in the 80s and 90s, right? But, my habits have changed. I just haven't been able to watch much. But I was always entertained. I always thought he was ridiculously funny. I really did. I was one of those people who just loved Letterman, loved the top 10 list, loved all the shtick. Larry Bud Melman, Paul Schaefer in the band, all of it. The shtick he would do out on the streets in New York City. I thought it was ingenious, great stuff from, the old timers, real old timers, told me is what it was, the kind of stuff Ernie Kovacs used to do on TV, if people even remember.
A little bit of Ernie Kovacs, although anyway. Kovacs was, Kovacs had an absolutely new medium that he was
playing with.
Yes, yeah.
And Letterman continued to play with it.
Yeah, he did.
It was good. And, it was that irreverence, that Midwestern sort of deflate ego thing that he was doing and did so well. And the 1980s was kind of a cultural, I wouldn't call it a wasteland, but there was a lot of stuff to make fun of in the 1980s and 90s. And he had a great time. I was a huge fan of but I sort of dropped off some years ago because I just frankly didn't stay up late, and I don't watch much of Letterman online.
Yeah.
Even the top 10 list. And some of it got old.
Yeah. Well, I have not been over the years as enamored of Letterman as you are, although I certainly respect him and admire what he accomplished. I think the thing about him, that's a couple of things you said there. Number one, he invented, inherited a formula from Johnny Carson, really.
Mm-hmm.
Carson was the guy who mastered that late night formula. But Carson had a mindset and a view of television and the world that was really more in line with the World War II generation, where you believed in television. You actually believed in it. People trusted it. People really thought it was their window to the world, mm-hmm. as the networks and the local television stations told us. You don't need anything but that thing box in your living room. We'll give the world to you. We'll give you Carnegie Hall. We'll give you the streets of Baltimore. If you were foolish enough to believe it, you were a Chauncey Gardner in Being There from Jerzy Kaczynski. But so he inherited that, and one of his greatest accomplishments, and really as a performer, television performer, is he cherished what Carson did, and he cherished that formula for late night television. So he didn't blow it up, or and he didn't mock it, and he didn't just tear it down and come in with something new. He learned how to perform within that formula. You know, it's like a classical musician learning to play all of the canon, you know, and then saying, now I'm going to turn some of this into jazz, you know. He did that. And he, as he did it, he playfully deconstructed that formula and showed the let the audience in on the artifice of the show business show that right. sometimes people showed up backstage in bad shape and some, right. you know what I'm saying. Right. All of that.
Or the cue cards were misspelled or something.
Yes, and and you saw it really in a great way. It should have been a great lesson for us not to trust TV, but people still do think what they see on TV is reality. He deconstructed it that way and showed us. The great thing is, and this is something that Letterman had a unique talent for. Well, not unique, but one of the keenest sensibilities for. The cheesiness of TV. Yeah. You know, from the early...
That's what I was getting at. A lot to make fun of. Right?
From the earliest days, from the earliest days with Bill Paley, that's the founder of CBS, and David Sarnoff, the founder of NBC, they wanted their networks to be classy. And so Sarnoff brought in Arturo Toscanini to lead the
orchestra.
NBC orchestra. Paid money that today that people would jump out a window if somebody said, we're playing this orchestra, all this money, get rid of them, get a recorder in there, and you know we'll spend the money on promotion. That's what counts today. Or we'll hire a lot of good people in social media to get our message out. Paley. Tiffany of networks, you know, and we grew up, you know, everything on the screen looked golden. It looked like Oscar night, you know, the logo, they had lights shining off it like the networks. And that's what they got people to believe, that these networks were these, television was this grand, magical sort of place of power and prestige and cool people. And the early shows had all these people. Even Let's Make a Line, these witty people like Cerf, Bennett Cerf, in a tuxedo, you know, and Dorothy Kilgallen in an evening gown.
Yeah.
By the way, Fox is still doing that on their network. They still got the same evening gowns on their anchor women. But
I hadn't noticed that. Still, they wear white gloves, too?
Their next step. If the ratings go down, they get the elbow-length gloves out there.
I was in love
and long cigarette hole. Yeah, you were in love
I was in love with Kitty Carlisle.
There we go. See? Sad. But
Bennett Cerf. Did you just say Bennett Cerf?
Bennett Cerf.
I love all these cultural references you're making so far. We've only been on the air for about 10 minutes.
Yeah, wait till my brain short circuits and the coffee stops. I'll be, oh, yeah, Dan. But seriously, but television isn't that way. As you know, you did a TV show. You know what rubber bands and glue it is. And and it's always cold.
And we stole from Letterman.
Yeah, and it's always cold in the studio, and it's kind of dirty a little bit. They never clean up. Right. And then they put the lights on to make it all look magical and happy, and they burn your brain, your hair falls
it's
out.
Showbiz.
Yes. And he shared that with the audience. That was a profound thing. We should have understood. And I think a generation grew up understanding more about media and being more cynical about it. And then, of course, he really did have a sense of irony.
I have a question for you. So when he moved to NBC, it was supposed to, to CBS, it was supposed to be a big deal, right? He was going after Leno.
Yeah.
But ultimately, Leno won that thing, right?
You know, that was an unbelievable thing. I remember being out on press tour in California when they announced it. And, you know, so they had all the critics, you know, about 100 of us out there in a hotel. I think it was Ritz-Carlton. We really suffered on these tours, by the way. but it was December and it rained every day and we got a cut rate thing. So the rooms we had, they had like mildew in them and stuff. But anyway, and I remember us when Les Moonves, the ringmaster, who's now the chairman of CBS, when he came out and made this announcement, and it was all baby boomer male critics at the time. That's what the critical community was. And of course,
the audience was, right?
Well, there was half of it was women, but no. Oh, you mean for him? I think
baby boomers.
Oh, yeah. And. You know, it was a huge, huge story. You know, and Bill Carter got a book out of it. Bill Carter.
Would you say Leno won that war?
You know, it depends on how you want to define won. Because ever since that war, people have, the critics at least, I would say there's a critical consensus that came directly out of that situation. See who was going to succeed Carson and how it played out. That Leno was a corporate kiss-up and was not, there was no edge to him. He kissed up to whoever was in power, and he did tame, lame jokes.
Yeah.
And
not it, as, just not as funny as edgy.
Yes, and yeah. And I think in some ways it was unfair. Jay Leno is actually a very smart comedian, very skilled at his craft.
And Dave, still does stand-up,
yes,
right?
And Dave Letterman was not that much edgier. When it came to politics and stuff, he wasn't out there with Mort Saul. You know what I'm saying? By a long shot. But that stuck. And I think it hurt Leno in some ways. I really do. And don't forget, the good news is...
You think it hurt Leno or hurt Letterman?
I think it hurt Leno in terms of his reputation that way.
Among critics.
Well, I think it also hurt him personally. I think he felt that way, that he never got his due, had a chip on his shoulder. And don't forget, the good news is you win, Jay, you get the Tonight Show. The bad news is NBC's the corporation you work for, and they're going to do all kinds of crazy stuff because they're NBC. Remember when they put them in primetime? At 10 o'clock?
We talked about it on
yes,
the air here.
Yeah. And the affiliates, you know.
But it lasts about 3 weeks.
And it was a huge embarrassment. Yeah. And it wasn't his fault. It was a knuckleheaded move by, I think it was Jeff Zucker who runs CNN now.
I want to ask our listeners about Leno versus Letterman.
Yeah, yeah.
Or since it's Letterman's last night, maybe we don't have to talk about Leno. Maybe you have some reflections about Letterman. Yeah. Maybe you're like me. You got hooked into him in the 80s and 90s. And I don't know, somewhere along the way, you kind of lost touch with Letterman. 33 years, a long time to pull that off.
I think these last shows are a little emotional. I think people who disconnected with him are reconnecting. And they realize something is being lost. When somebody who has a 33-year run is leaving, that something's going on in our culture where things don't last like that anymore.
We have to take a break. Even if you're not a baby boomer, you probably recognize this tune. It's one of the most successful television commercials of all time, and it's the image, the last image, that people saw in the final episode of AMC's Mad Men on Sunday night. We invite our listeners to weigh in on the ending. How did you feel about that ending? Did it satisfy you? Were you frustrated by it? 410-662-8780. That's our phone number here for Midday on Media with David Zurawick. We'll be right back.
Teach the world to sing.
Sing with me.
That's a tune from a 1970s. 71 Coke commercial. As if it wasn't already culturally significant, the finale of AMC's Mad Men has brought it into relevance and added another layer of meaning. As expected, critics have had mixed reviews about the final scene by Mad Men's creator, Matthew Weiner, who's from here.
He was born here, yeah. He was born here. He grew up in Los Angeles.
Now, some people have called this a perfect ending. Some people said it was, as I said, one critic I saw him say, it was too neat, everything tied in a bow. I don't want that from a show that's been sort of had a lot of ambiguity in it. Some felt frustrated by it. Some were delighted by it. David Zurawick, how were you by it?
Well, in that sense, it reminds me of The Sopranos. Remember The Sopranos?
Oh, yeah.
The fierce debate afterwards. It was a great ending. It was a terrible ending.
Oh, yeah. Tony went black.
Yeah, and people were, some of them, after you go through a lot of these shows, and there aren't that many of them, but when you go through some of these shows that really connect with the culture in powerful and deep ways, and people form all kinds of bonds with them. After a while, you sort of maybe bemused is the right word. You get bemused about some of the crazy speculation of what these meanings are, and you sort of go, "Hey, you know what? I went through that in English Lit from 1920 to 1945, the seminar, you know? No, actually, T.S. Eliot would be a better one, probably. But
it's fun. It's recreation for the mind.
I'm not mocking it because I make a living doing it. So maybe I don't like the competition is what's really going on. But seriously, only the shows that you really connect with do you do that with. I mean, that's a sign that people really care about it. the ending to me was, here's my bottom line on it. There's the good news about it is, like literature, it's open to multiple readings, and everything's open to multiple readings based on the reader's history. But works of art, I think, have a limited number of readings that you can talk about being valid, that have some relationship to, you can credibly make a case for them. And I think one reading, the reading that I sort of felt I walked away with, although I'm perfectly willing for somebody to argue me, talk me out of it, is that in the end, this is who Draper is, just an ad man. He'll take any experience and turn it in to a successful advertisement. You think he's on the verge of rebirth as a human being, but it's not.
Right.
But you were tricked one last time.
Right.
And I say, okay, as a storyteller, Matthew Weiner, hats off. Good job. My expectations, I wanted more. You used my expectations to trick me into believing you were going to give me more. But in the end, this is who you're saying Don Draper is. Was it worth, then, my question, me spending all those seasons every Sunday night with this guy on his journey, if that's all he is? Now, in a way, because...
That's very interesting, because you've referred to it as an existential...
Yes, yes.
Existential experience,
yes,
of Mad Men.
Yes, yes.
So, actually, you're right, because that sort of just drops you in the middle of the road, doesn't it? If it's you're on an existential journey and you find out that Don Draper is just... making a Coke commercial,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes.
Another commercial.
Yeah, and you know, and people, you know, then you want to say, oh, and these people who make these ads, have they made America a better place? I mean, have they raised the level of our lives with these ads, you know? So why should I care this much about this man? And maybe... for a narcissistic storyteller like Matthew Weiner, maybe it feels good to be able to have that kind of control over your audience. And I grant it, he did have that kind of control over me. But at the end, I thought, okay, is this all there is? Is that what this is? Is that who he is? Oh, he made an iconic commercial. Great. So what? Did I want to spend all that time with him? So that's my reaction to it. So in that, Dan, I think you can see where each of those kinds of, I liked it, I was disappointed, is this all there is? All of that sort of possible within that reading of it, I think. I really do.
MacGyver on Twitter. That's a MacGyver. That's MacGyver.
Thanks, guys. It's not the real MacGyver.
No, it's not the real MacGyver. Okay. I don't know what would be
happening.
Because
I thought he was going to take some bubble gum and make a plane
That is the Twitter handle of one of our listeners who says Sally and Joan's endings were flipped in my mind, which was surprising, and I thought Don would kill himself. So you didn't need a Don Draper suicide to feel fulfilled, did you? It wasn't that bad, was
okay,
it?
Dan.
I know he had his dark moments.
I'm a dark guy, you know. I'm not Mr. Sunshine and Lollipops. And maybe I think you're saying here, Zerwick, if he'd have jumped off the ledge into the Pacific Ocean, you'd have liked that, huh?
Yeah.
I thought, that would have seemed, well, I got to be careful, but you know what, if he sits down at that phone booth at the end, thing in the end, and says, I can't move, which, by the way, that didn't strike me as real existential paralysis. You know, when you look in the abyss and you're frozen, it didn't. I thought, what did he eat? Something he doesn't feel too good. He's sitting down.
weren't convinced.
No, I was not convinced. So, in connection with that, if he had that moment, walking to the edge of the ocean as a sort of an abyss, but it would also be a symbol of rebirth, possibly to some blah blah blah. I see. I sat in that seminar. I can't remember who it is, but when they left him in the penultimate episode, sitting at a bus stop in Oklahoma, I remember, I flashed back to grad school, some damn darn course where the last thing, it's probably John Barth, but the last thing, he's in a terminal, you know, and he's in a bus terminal. And when the professor said to me, see, a terminal can be an ending, or a terminal means ending, but it could also be a beginning. And I was like, man, wow.
I want to smoke some of that.
I was like, why do they make this so complicated?
Is this Mexican?
That's what I would ask. I have a question for you.
Okay.
Important question. Why was Mad Men an important series?
Why was Mad Men?
Yeah, I know it's a large question. 7 seasons, but why? Why is this such an important TV series?
I think initially, and I think through most of it, it explored really brilliantly the concept of identity, of how we socially construct our identity. People think identity's fixed, you're born this, you know, but it isn't. We invent ourselves as we go along. Hmm. And in the last 15 years or so, I think, America has become just obsessed and wrapped up in identity. And we talk about identity politics, you know? And we really only, maybe it's just me, but I really only, I'd say in the last 15 years, got this notion of how we construct our own identity. You know, I remember when I was doing my dissertation on Jewish characters in primetime, they said, oh, you got to define what Jewish means, you know, and I went, oh, God. And so then I had a religious definition, I had a cultural definition, mm-hmm. I had a secular definition. Finally, what the people in my committee settled on is, you're Jewish if you say you're Jewish. You know, well, we had a raging debate, but in a way, that's what it is. You can assume an identity, and if you embrace certain aspects of it, you are it. Well, this show really did that with Draper, who stole another man's name, literally, another identity.
With the characters and with the craft.
Well, I think,
right?
I think with
their profession.
Well, that's a good point. I was only thinking of the characters, mm-hmm. like him in his life. But that's true. That's true. They also do that. So that's one thing. It was really smart about media and advertising and showed us that connection. The same as Letterman, in a way, showed us how it's artificial and how it's cooked up. And also, it was so smart in that regard that it made us think about our deepest feelings for media objects. You know, when in the final episode of the first season, when Don Draper is pitching what's called the wheel, but it's the carousel from Kodak that shows slides. And he talks about memory and the Greek word memory and the pain of memory and the beauty. It's a brilliant, brilliant speech. They understood that. Now, in the finale, the AMC promoted it with a sort of montage. And they played that Neil Sedaka, The Times of Your Life or something? It was so kitschy.
Yes, right.
It was so...
Was it Neil Sedaka? He either wrote it or he sang it, yeah.
The Times of Your... Yeah. It was so kitschy. And I thought, well, that's what television does. It takes something profound and cheapens it down till they make it into a Hallmark card or something sentimental. Yeah. But that was... You can't blame Weiner. That's the network or the channel that paid him to do that.
We have a clip that's, I think, from the scene that you're talking
about. Wow.
This is
wow.
Don Draper pitching an ad campaign to Kodak.
That's it.
This is it?
That's it. That's brilliant.
The idea he's selling to Kodak in this clip turns out to be one of the most appealing aspects of the show for the baby boomer audience.
This is it. This is the moment I loved it. Last episode, season one.
The public can be engaged on a level beyond flash if they have a sentimental bond with the product. My first job. I was in-house at a fur company with this old pro copywriter, Greek, named Teddy. And Teddy told me the most important idea in advertising is new. It creates an itch. You simply put your product in there as a kind of calamine lotion. But he also talked about a deeper bond with the product. Nostalgia. It's delicate. Potent.
That's it. Nostalgia. It was one of the most profound. And that
he's
was
selling nostalgia.
And he was selling these images from family life. And the genius of it is that those images do have profound meaning for us when we go back and look at them. I mean, we are transported back, and there is, it's really, I think it's what you would call melancholy. It's a sweet pain. It, you know, you smile a little bit at the memory, but it hurts because those people are the, maybe it's a picture of one of your pets. They're no longer with you, you know, and...
Well, you made the point in your piece in The Sun, in your farewell to Mad Men and to Letterman, you say, and to boomers, or to TV for boomers? Is that what you're thinking?
Boomers, the message of these two shows as they leave the airwaves from the television industry is, you know what, boomers, we're not programming to you anymore. You've
had your time?
You're over the hill, man. You were definitely over the hill.
We're not interested in your demographic.
We're not the dominant culture anymore. We're not part of the dominant culture. We're not center stage in popular culture. And that's a hard thing, I think, for a lot of boomers to deal with, because we grew up and our parents told us we were so fabulous and there were so many of us and they built colleges for us and they did all this stuff. And we had so many people, Dan, from our generation who are selfish, narcissistic, really kind of awful people who think they're great people.
There
are
Kodak carousels full of photographs of us. Yes.
And now it's going to be very tough. I got a lot of...
While you're on this subject, though,
yes.
Is there a show that's for boomers that's left, per se? I mean, could you say Mad Men wasn't just for boomers, because a lot of young people loved it.
Oh, no.
It was a cool show.
Yes.
But, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's that generation. So there's the nostalgia appeal. Letterman, certainly.
Yeah.
But what's left then?
Yeah, I'll answer that in a second. But, no, I'm so glad you made that distinction. Mad Men was not a show for boomers. Its appeal to boomers was that it celebrated the 60s, which boomers, you know, never be a decade like the 60s. It was so great. We were so great, blah, blah, blah. So it let them wallow in their 60s nostalgia. But it had tremendous appeal to younger viewers and people who were not boomers. That was its success. In terms of what's absolutely left for boomers, you know, you look around, even at the anchor desks at the network, you know, David Muir is like 41 at ABC. Mm-hmm. Diane Sawyer left last year. She was a boomer.
Scott Pelley's actually older.
Yeah, he's in the mid-50s, I think 57, so he kind of comes in. But he's that tail end of it where they're not boomers, you know, not their parents didn't have him right after World War II. So, you know, Brian Williams is going to never be back at the anchor desk. Right. There's a boomer. I mean, and he's...
Oh, did you just say Brian Williams is never going to be back at the anchor desk?
I would be shocked. Really, the last hair on my head would fall out if he's back at the anchor desk. Might be. Networks are crazy. The media industry is crazy. But I don't think he's coming back anyway in the name of God.
We're gonna take a break here. And because you just brought up Brian Williams, we will shift into our other subject, which has to do with George Stephanopoulos and ABC News, when we get back here with Midday on Media with David Zurawiec. But you can give us a call if you want to talk about Mad Men or Letterman, 410-662-8780. If you have a question for David about what's on TV, just give us a ring.
Bye.
And welcome back to Midday on Media. Yeah, get shorty. You haven't seen that movie?
You gotta be.
It's
in
a good movie.
You gotta be in a nightclub. The lights are down now.
Kick that up. Let's listen to this.
The band's taking the band. You pick your harmonica off the Fender amp. I did. I played with a blues band in college. Yeah.
This
is the way you start a set.
Yeah.
You know, because it's easy. People coming back, they're chattering, glasses clinking. All of a sudden, you tear into this, and that place goes, wow, can that boy play?
David Zurawiec is our guest. It's Midday on Media. It's the third Wednesday of the month. David visiting us again. So, by the way, you mentioned Foo Fighters, right?
Yeah, tonight on Letterman.
Do you know anything else about that show?
I don't. That's all I know.
Late Night with David Letterman.
I think that's all I know, except maybe I do know if there's a guest. Let me just look at this. I printed it when I was coming over here.
Our engineer, Luke Spicknell, says he heard that. Did you hear this up, or are you going to Google it for me fast before I say it on the air? I don't want to tell people that Tom Hanks is going to be on if he's not going to be on.
I think
check it.
I think
check it. If your mother says she loves you, check it out.
It's a basic in the news business.
No. Not the social media generation. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if it's wrong.
I heard this.
No, just keep rolling along. We don't.
I heard this.
We don't correct anything. We only update. That's the way we're at. Right? See, nobody gets mad anymore at that.
Can we have a 5-minute debate on George Stephanopoulos?
Yes, I'm happy to.
You're upset. Yeah. Very upset. Yeah. That George Stephanopoulos, who is co-anchor of Good Morning America.
Anchor of the Sunday show.
Made a donation of $75,000 to the Clinton Foundation. Yeah. Bill and Chelsea Clinton's Global Initiative. And he didn't disclose it.
Did not disclose it.
And he thought, well, it would come out because, you know, all of that stuff is reported by the foundation. I didn't feel any need to tell my employer, ABC News.
Yeah, I didn't tell ABC News.
And you say George Stephanopoulos has lost all political credibility because of this.
Totally. And you know what made this worse is about 2 weeks ago he interviewed the guy who wrote the Clinton cash book. And if you go look at
questioning donations made to the Clinton Foundation while Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State.
Exactly. And essentially, I think this is fair to the author of that book. It's more stronger than a suggestion. He walked right up to the line of alleging that there were quid pro quos when people donated countries, people in Colombia. I mean, really, I shouldn't characterize it, but really questionable. Let me say questionable. Mm-hmm. People donating money and things then happening in those countries. But he also questions a whole range of stuff about how the money's spent, about what's appropriate in such a.
But no definitive wrongdoing.
No. I think it's fair to say that, you know, when people say there's no smoking gun, his defense on that, by the way, is,
who's
look,
his?
You read, he says,
the
you,
author? Or
yeah, the author. Okay. The author says, hey, you read Sunday newspapers like the New York Times, you know, blah, blah, blah. They don't have smoking guns in most of their investigations. You know, they walk it up to a line and say, oh, look at this. This is going on. People are paying this and getting this.
Okay.
So
I'll give you some of that. But okay. Get to Stephanopoulos then. What's the problem with him giving money to a foundation?
Well, it's a Clinton Foundation. First of all, it's a political candidate, number one, who is running the foundation, who's a president, who he's covering, for God's sakes. It's outrageous.
Wait a minute. It's Bill and Hillary and Chelsea Clinton Foundation.
Yeah, and Hillary's running for president, in case you hadn't heard.
Yeah, I know that.
And he's covering her, okay?
It's not a political donation to her campaign.
And he's interviewing the guy who wrote the book questioning this foundation. And the interview is one of the most one-sided, aggressive, prosecutorial conversations you will ever see on network TV if you looked at it.
I mean, Stephanopoulos grilled the guy.
Worse than grilled.
Didn't buy that there was anything nefarious.
It was like this. We here at ABC News have investigated this, and there's no smoking gun. Absolutely no wrongdoing. Absolutely no wrongdoing. No smoking. He repeated.
He was that adamant about it.
Yeah, he was that. And he looked like his face was contorted. He was so on it.
And did not disclaim that he had given $75,000.
And it never occurred to the former director of political communications at the White House that he should have disclosed this as he's attacking this guy? Come on. Okay. I am so angry about that. And you know why? Because I'm one of the people who, against my better judgment, gave him the benefit of doubt. I said, you know what? Other people have come from politics, and some of them have been have expiated their sins. And that's what I think of people in national political life. You want to come into journalism? They should send you out in a desert with no water and let you bake until you're almost dead and all your sins are burned away, and then you can join the profession of journalist and try to tell me how pure you are. He didn't have to do that. He didn't have to go wander in the desert for 30 days and recant his sins. He didn't have to go to a re-education camp and get right with the First Amendment.
He just had to disclose. Is that what you're saying?
That would have been nice. Are you saying
he shouldn't have given the money to the foundation?
I don't think he should have come near. Dan, can you give?
I'm with you. Wait a minute. I just want to hear you because to me, the problem is when you give donations to a political campaign of someone who's running for office and maybe governor or mayor someday, right?
Yeah.
I just personally, we can't do it.
We can't do it.
We're not supposed to do it at the Baltimore Sun. We sign an ethics code every year that says you can't do that. But here you're talking about giving money to a charitable foundation.
If Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake
had a charity,
had a charitable foundation, do you think you could give money to it and still be a columnist at the Baltimore Sun without disclosing it?
No. No, my employer wouldn't allow that, and I wouldn't do it because it's somebody I'm covering.
Well, that's exactly what he did.
And it, but I, you know, I'm trying to think of what's wrong with it. If I give a donation to a political campaign, that's clearly wrong.
If he
if I give a money that goes for charitable work in the name of the mayor has a charitable foundation. I'm trying to think of what's ethically wrong with that. I'm currying favor with the mayor. The mayor might give me an interview that I wouldn't ordinarily get.
You're supporting her beliefs, and she's somebody you should be covering impartially. I don't care if her beliefs are holy and sacred and wonderful.
Like in this case, saving the rainforest. And what else does the Clinton Foundation do?
He said he did it because he was concerned about AIDS. And I think it was AIDS in Africa, but it may have just been global AIDS he was talking about, but AIDS. And he thought they did such good work in it. Well, you know what? There's a lot of organizations you could give to who would do that work and would spend your money. And by the way, would be more transparent about where your money's going, number one. But number two, who have no political baggage. You know, now there's this whole narrative out there, and it's a very strong narrative, that the Clintons aren't the Clintons got rich.
Yeah.
You know? Now, part of it is making speeches for outrageous, just like Ronald Reagan. Remember how people went nuts when Reagan went over to Japan and gave a speech? Bill Clinton does it every week, practically. He says he's got to do it to pay the bills there out in New Jersey.
I need to ask something. Do you think Stephanopoulos had credibility in the classic sense of a co-anchor of a show, a person who asks questions, tries to be objective and fair? You get a little bit of his opinion here and there. But for the most part, he's trying to be an even-handed journalist.
I think he did. And I will tell you how I think what proved it is they named him. They made David Muir anchor of World News Tonight. But at the same time, they named him the chief anchor and political anchor for ABC News, replacing Diane Sawyers in the chief anchor. They made him the face of ABC News. That's also why this is such a bad situation for ABC News and why they're going to just say there's no problem here. Just like WBAL did with Jane Miller on the conflict in the Freddie Gray case. BAL so invested, they're going to say, after it was reported, then they say, we looked at it. No conflict. Never mind. Move on. That's what ABC hopes will happen. I don't think it will happen because at the level of ABC News, as opposed to Baltimore TV, which is the 26th market in the country, there's deeper scrutiny and there's a political divide where I think the right is not going to let up on him. But Dan, to answer your question, just from my point,
I mean, he's always been a political insider. The idea that George Stephanopoulos is comparable to David Brinkley, for instance, it's just never been a concept with me. I've never accepted that.
How about Diane Sawyer? How about her?
Yeah, well, her time in the White House was quite a while ago. That's true.
But she did go to San Clemente.
With
Nixon. She was very young.
When she started at ABC, there wasn't that much distance between that her political career and her so-called journalism career.
And she went through CBS and 60 Minutes.
But she didn't have a credibility problem.
Yeah, I didn't think she...
You never had something like this come back and bite her.
No, she was smart enough not to give money to people.
Before time runs out, Lorraine called in because she wanted to say something about Mad Men. And Lorraine, excuse me, let me just announce that Tom Hanks was on...
there you go, see?
With Letterman,
there you go, thank you.
But it was Monday night.
There you go, see?
It wasn't... It's not tonight.
Go ahead, mock.
We know so far that Foo Fighters will be on tonight, that's about all we know, right?
That's because Zerwick confirmed it, and he's from your generation.
Thank you very much. Your mother says she loves you. Check it out. Lorraine in Harford County. Hello, Lorraine.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good.
I'm good,
the show's
too,
almost over.
Thanks.
Good.
Okay.
I'm kidding.
Well, my only comment was what David Zerwick was talking about, Mad Men, and he was looking for a different ending and all this existentialism, and that's not Don. I watched that show for the pure enjoyment of watching a guy with very few moral scruples but really good looking. See what he did. And I mean, the show was wonderful and that was so perfect. I mean, you know, because I'm in that baby boomer age, so I remember, mm-hmm. I remember women being treated like crap, you know, at offices. And I remember the clothes. I remember the, I mean, I could even look at one of the wallpapers, said, God, I remember that wallpaper, you know, that kind of stuff. But really, Dom was just a man of his age. I mean, he was not a particularly deep guy. I think he got a little bit of Nirvana down there. You know, he went to that hippie meditation place, which was really Eastland, that East Allen Institute, when you get right down to it. And he went there, you know, got, you know, meditated a little bit, then got this bright idea, made the Coke commercial.
I'm with her.
I agree. Listen,
he's an ad guy.
Lorraine, I do not disagree with you.
The ultimate for the ad guy is the Coke commercial,
and
is
I'm,
it not?
Yeah, and I'm so glad you brought that point of view to it. I honestly totally agree with you. I have nothing to disagree. You're right. Zurich was looking for all that existential.
She won you over. Yeah, she completely changed your mind in the last 50 minutes.
She did. It was really good.
I've never been able to change your mind about anything.
Well, she also really spoke about the pleasure a lot of people got from this show and how they engaged it. And I totally agree. I wouldn't disagree with one word you said.
Mark wrote in by email just to say about Stephanopoulos and the Clinton Foundation. It would be one thing if Stephanopoulos gave $100 like a normal person, but $75,000.
Good point. Good point.
Yeah, that is kind of.
Oh, this is the world.
That will get the attention of the Clintons.
You know what drives me crazy? I'm going to tell you this. You know this because you were kind enough to let me talk about this on the show. Chelsea Clinton, $1.8 million NBC gave her for 3 seasons on Brian Williams' show. It's the other reason I don't like Brian Williams. Yeah. $600,000 a year showcased her on that pitiful magazine he had. While people who go to school, go to internships, go to South Dakota to get work on stations to work their way up, they can't get a job in this America. The Clintons are the ultimate one percenters. You know, if you think you're progressive,
the ultimate. How are they the ultimate one percenters?
Because they had the power once to rein in Wall Street, to do the kinds of things Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders want to do, and they didn't do it. They sold out. They bought in. They took their money. Now they got the big house. Now Bill's ticking. They had a chance to change America, and they didn't.
Bernie's launching his campaign this weekend up in Vermont.
I love Bernie. I love him. The way he's hammering her from the left is so beautiful.
Hey, John wants to know, how is George's contribution? Thank you for not having forcing me to say Stephanopoulos again. How is George's contribution any different than tithing a religious organization? I would say probably your local bishop is not running for president of the United States. That's one.
Yeah, but you know what? If you're making extra charitable contributions like to the Episcopal Church and then you're asked to cover the bishop who was the frock story, I think if you're going out of your way to give extra money beyond sort of a straight whatever 10%, you should divulge that. Dan, you and I both know. Divulge. Yep. Tell people what the heck you are. Be transparent. You can never get in trouble for telling people the truth in this business.
Thank you, David.
Ooh, I love that music.
Hey,
that
I got a guess here. Leno on Letterman tonight? What do you think?
Ooh, I think that's
c'est
too
possible?
Much.
C'est possible.
It's possible. Yes, you are. You are my friend. That would be it. You would be Karnak. If you're right.
Karnak the Magnificent.
I will come back and you will be wearing a turban and holding an envelope to your head.
Hey, we have lunch from Kenilworth Farmers Market.
I had a cookie out there and it was delicious. Yeah, I had a oatmeal raisin and it was fabulous.
Thanks for being here, David.
Thank you. I had a good time.
See you in Calvert Street in about a half an hour. Hey, everybody, have a great afternoon. We'll see you again tomorrow for another midday.
's producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producers are Michael Himowitz, Melody Simmons, and Connor Graham. Our interns are Aaron Morenzi, Alexis Kuhn, and Aaliyah Satterfield. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming is available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.